we continually hear about kelp being this kind of miracle, seaweed, you know, being this miraculous. But I think what we're focused on here right now is to really begin a very strong kelp seaweed farming and kelp industry here in the United States.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and today we have a big, tasty topic to savor: seaweed. Yes, some of you may be turning up your noses, thinking only of seaweed as some slimy, smelly stuff wrapping around your legs and your anchors in the ocean, a beach blighter, and something that's not much good for anything except sushi. Well, you couldn't be more wrong. This wonderful aquatic organism possesses multiple useful applications, as witnessed by the increasing number of marine scientists, ecologists, entrepreneurs, and foodies who are starting to appreciate seaweed's remarkable properties. To prove how harnessing the power of seaweed might help us save the planet, we have three great guests from around the world today. Joining us first from Ireland, Stefan Kraan is a Dutch marine biologist who now lives in Galway, where he's founder of the Seaweed Company. Sean Barrett is founder of Dr. Dish and the Montauk Seaweed Supply Company in Long Island. And Vincent Demoiselle is joining us from France, where he is head of the Safe Seaweed Coalition. So welcome to you all three. Okay, let me start with you, Stefan. You're a marine biologist originally from Holland who came to Galway to study over 20 odd years ago, and you fell in love with seaweed. Why are you excited about the global prospects for seaweed?
Well, yes, seaweed is an inherent part of my life. I studied seaweeds in a time in the Netherlands at a university where all my fellow students were looking at dolphins or whales or fish, and I was the odd one out looking at seaweeds. Now, there was a working group or a department in our university that was dealing with seaweeds. So that's where I started getting, well, immersed basically in the world of seaweeds. And in the first instance, it was about the beauty of seaweeds. If you dry seaweeds on a special cardboard or paper, you get the really nice prints. And I once made all my Christmas cards like that for the whole family. But you do that only once because it's a lot of work, I can tell you. But that captured my imagination with seaweeds. And then I started to learn about why seaweeds are growing in a certain area, because it's constricted by temperature, by day length, by light, and all these kind of stuff. And it evolved more and more, and I started really studying it, and then went to Ireland to do my PhD, basically, in seaweed, in aquaculture, as well as molecular genetics. So that is how it all started, basically.
And then how did you hop from the lab to business?
I was lucky that after my PhD, we set up the Irish Seaweed Industry Organization and the Irish Seaweed Center. And the Irish Seaweed Center was a research center in the university looking for applications of seaweeds in all the marvelous things that we do nowadays with seaweeds. And fertilizer is one, but pharma and medical applications or bioplastics or food or feed are other applications. So that is where we started about 15 years ago with a company called Ocean Harvest Technology. And I run that for 10 years. And that was purely focused on animal feed applications. And then I stepped out of that and set up the seaweed company. And now we do the whole spectrum from fertilizer to pharma.
Interesting. How differently, first of all, the Dutch, how do they farm seaweed? Because they don't have the off-coast seaweed farms that we have in other parts of the world. And how different do the Dutch handle seaweed as compared to the old honored hand-hewn method they used to have in Galway? I don't know if you still harvest by hand in Galway.
Well, to come to that last point, yes, there is still a lot of hand harvesting, 25,000 tons to be precise. But it is one type of seaweed, Ascophyllum or Famine Wee, as they call it in Gaelic. And it's used mainly for horticulture, agriculture, and animal feed. And that industry started in 1949, just after the Second World War, and is still ongoing. And they do the right thing in the way they sustainably harvest and treat their own resource, because it's still there, still bountiful, still in the same way. The Dutch, on the other hand, only have basically sandy beaches, so no seaweed. You need rock for seaweeds to attach to. And only in the south, in Zeeland, which is the most southerly province, they have dikes, the Eastern Scheldt. That's where there is some seaweed. And that Dutch farm called Zeewaar, they, well, we recently took that over. And they have a small seaweed farm, only 3 basically hectares, in a small enclosed area in a harbor. So the methodology is still the same. How they grow seaweeds and how we do here in Ireland is the same kind of methodologies with seed and string and ropes and all this kind of stuff.
Okay, well, we're going to get into that in a minute so people understand how it actually goes from being a spore on a rope and then how you harvest it. But let's move over to Montauk now, to you, Sean. Sean farms seaweed commercially. I think you started off as a fisherman. So what spurred the move to produce seaweed as a natural form of fertilizer for farms and gardens and golf courses? And why did you get fired up about it? Not just as a business prospect, but as part of a kind of holistic community environmental impact organization?
Yeah, I began working as a very young kid. I was fascinated and obsessed with oceans and fish, and was just, my parents used to say, they'd have to pry the fishing rod out of my hands when I was a very young boy. So I started an early obsession with oceans and sea life, and then had just always had a very strong attachment and pursuit of trying to create ways to conserve the ocean kind of resources. So that led us over the years to start working in fisheries. Dr. Dish, as you mentioned, was we borrowed some ideas from some farmers here in the US. But concurrently, the kelp kind of conversation in the US about 10 years ago, on the East Coast here of the US, a company called Atlantic Sea Farms, they're up in Maine. And they came down to New York and approached us to work with them and help them try to introduce kelp as a food source. So naturally in the seafood world, in our proximity to New York City, we were doing a lot of work with advanced forward-thinking chefs. So there was a natural kind of marriage there between the Maine kelp farmers who were trying to introduce kelp as food into our seafood system. And we began bringing kind of Maine kelp, sugar kelp is what we grow here, in as a food substance, and began trying to get Americans to eat kelp, which we learned many lessons along the way, as we always do. But yeah, that kind of brought us to one of the bigger problems that we have in seafood, in processing especially, is waste. So about 6 or 7 years ago, we were working in seafood, we were working with kelp as food, but in our seafood sector, we were creating huge volumes of waste and trying to figure out, like, what can we do with all this waste from the processing? And our relationships with some local organic farms in Eastern Long Island, we learned that the farmers were very keen to take the leftover fish waste and start to put that in their soil, you know, to strengthen the soil. And so we started to freeze a lot of our, you know, the leftovers from the fish processing, and then bring that to the farmers, and they start to use that to strengthen their soil. So then the light turned on for me then, that, hey, what would happen if we started to kind of harness these nutrients and things that are in the fish? Often they're similar in the kelp and aquatic vegetation. What if we started to push kelp and seaweed into the soil? So this kind of like thinking, this vision was going around for a while, but then I got very humbled by the Shinnecock Nation, which is an indigenous tribe in Eastern Long Island, who I thought I had this really brilliant idea and was running around telling everyone about it. And a few of my friends from the Shinnecock Nation were like, dude, this is like, we've been doing this for thousands of years. This is a very ancient indigenous practice. So since that time, we've worked pretty closely with them. They've now started the Shinnecock kelp farmers. And we were trying to begin this sea to soil movement, where I think here in Eastern Long Island, the number one problem as inhabitants of the planet, I think that we're all trying to address is carbon capture. So that's the most, you know, compelling thing about kelp farming to us, is its ability to capture carbon. And then we're putting that straight into soil and sequestering, pulling it out, you know, of the atmosphere, basically. So our hope is that there's still a lot of science, and I'm sure Vince can speak to this, but, you know, about carbon capture in the kelp space, number one. But for us, right behind that is nitrogen. So we suffer in Eastern Long Island from, we're in the top 5% of the highest nitrogen content in our local waterways, and it continually causes shellfish die-offs, fish kills, Every few weeks, you'll hear someone's pet goes in, drinks the water, and there's all types of hypoxic events and problems with nitrogen loading that's coming from the golf courses, the farms, agricultural runoff from New York City. So one of the most compelling, right behind carbon, was the nitrogen sequestering capacity for these kelp farms. And so we're trying to solve a whole bunch of different problems in one, and that we continually hear about kelp being this kind of miracle, seaweed, you know, being this miraculous. But I think what we're focused on here right now in Eastern Long Island, because we are still so new compared to Europe and certainly to Asia, the United States is way, we're last. We're like we're so far behind. But I think that we're building right now the foundational building blocks on law and science to really begin a very strong kelp farming and kelp industry here in the United States.
Okay, well, I think people, somebody's written a couple of questions in here, and one was actually a question I had lined up for you. Just briefly, could you explain the process of how you are farming seaweed? If it's not being, you know, harvested straight off the beach, you have to create these lines and then put the spores. So if you could explain that a little bit. And then also you talked to me a bit about creating an ecosystem where in that environment you could have mussels and perhaps oysters as well. So I'm interested in how you would keep that healthy and controlled and organic, because you care about that stuff.
Yeah, great question. And I think it differs dramatically on where you're building them, what species you're growing, what type of water, sheltered areas, open ocean, inshore. What we've begun here in New York, now is only our third year, is inshore kelp farming in shallow water, only 6 to 8 feet. We're learning a lot of lessons about the pros and cons of that. Specifically, ice has been teaching us some humbling lessons the last few winters. But it's relatively straightforward. I mean, you have a buoy system with some rope. You have some spores on a line that go around there. And if you have the right growing conditions, kelp in certain areas, we grow a sugar kelp here that's native to our area and that can grow pretty rapidly if it's got the right conditions. But there are all types of variables. Anytime you're dealing with the wild, the open ocean, you know, you have to understand like the ocean is the boss, the natural elements. So it differs where you're growing, where you're located, your farms. But we basically had to create the first legal framework in New York State. It was not legal to farm kelp up until this year.
You weren't tribal. Years. Yeah.
Exactly. So we had the kelp bill finally got passed, which was, you know, it was legal to grow and sell the other weed, but seaweed was still outlawed. So we knew we had to balance that out. But yeah, I think to answer the original question, it's all shapes and sizes. We see kelp farms, the Safe Seaweed Coalition on their website, I've seen them give examples in Asia of these enormous mile, kilometer long kelp farms, you know, but here in New York, we have small artisanal, these are independently operated. And I think the second part of your question, what we're really trying to do is create polyculture farms. So nature really does not like it when you farm just monocultures. We've seen a lot of mistakes that have been made on land in farming. We're trying very hard to avoid making those same mistakes in the water. And one of the great ones is to just grow one singular species of anything. So we know diversity is the key to having a successful, balanced, thriving, any type of farm you're going to try to grow, basically. So ultimately, our goal and what we're doing now in New York is basically taking existing oyster farms and kind of retrofitting them to become oyster kelp combination farms. There's a lot of reasons why that is. The oyster farmers are typically experienced watermen who already know a lot of the ecosystem. They have the equipment, they have the boats, they have the experience, the knowledge, the know-how. And so that's ultimately the goal for us, is to start to create these small, independently owned polyculture operations where you're growing multiple species, multiple low trophic species in the same farm.
Okay, tons of questions. People are really into this, about where to eat, how to cook, prepare, where to buy. Is there a local seaweed to purchase? So let me go to Vincent. Bonsoir, Vincent, over there in Saint-Malo. So in a nutshell, do you think that seaweed is a wonderfully underestimated subject? And you've just written a book about it, so you must think it's pretty important.
Yes, I did. I did wrote a book which is called The Seaweed Revolution, and we should sign for the English translation this year. It's performing very well in France, so we this week, sorry. But just to answer your question, I think it is more than Maldives. I think it is the greatest untapped resource we have on this planet, and that has the potential to support addressing some of the most pressing challenge we have in this world. Just a short story about myself. I come from the food business, so I'm not a seaweed specialist as Stefan is. I really come from the food business, and I worked many years with the likes of the Nestlé CEOs and Cargill and Danone and Mars CEOs, and just realizing that they have no solution to feed the world of tomorrow, meaning that we have 300,000 people in addition to feed every day on the planet. We have to produce because of the calories demand and the diet changes. We have to provide produce as much food in the next 50 years or so as we ever produced over the last 10,000 years. That's kind of a complex equation. And in addition, the yields are stable. The cities are growing bigger and bigger. And you don't have much arable land left and so forth. So we have a big trouble. And in the meantime, we are the first generation to know that these food systems and our ecological system in general, these food systems are the biggest contributor to the greenhouse gas and to climate change. Biggest contributor to water scarcity, to soil depletion, to biodiversity loss, and to social injustice as well. Just remember that coffee, cocoa, and sugar—I mean, you for sure had some of it today—are the biggest contributor to modern slavery in the world today. So once again, there's something to change totally, and no one has a start of a solution for that. Then you look at the ocean, and you realize that 70% of the world is covered by ocean. That contribute to less than 2% of the planet, of the food that we have in the planet. So 2% of our calories come from the ocean only, while it covers 2/3 of our planet. So if you really want to have a growth avenue in terms of food production, you have to look at the ocean. And it's not only, if you look at the ocean, if you really want to grow food and other type of resources in a more than sustainable, because talking about sustainability when it comes to the ocean is irrelevant. I mean, we have destroyed already 50% of the ecosystem in the ocean. So talking about sustainability is irrelevant. We have to talk about restoration or regenerative agriculture, which is exactly what Chan explained. So if we want to start to rebuild ecosystem at sea instead of keeping destroying them as we do right now, seaweed is the best place to start because it is the lowest trophic level. So it can really feed and support the other part of the ecosystem. And then seaweed, I mean, just one thing first, just that I realize and worth to say, we talk a lot about kelp, but there's over 12,000 type of macroalgae, so seaweed, which are very different. A green seaweed is more different to from a genetic perspective to a green seaweed than a fungi is to an elephant. So that is really, really different. It's important to note because this wide range of genetic diversity offers an equally wide range of applications. So seaweed for what? Seaweed to support food and diet and human food, of course. I mean, we know that in Japan, seaweed makes up 10% of the food and contribute to long life expectancy, low level of cancer, diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. And so forth. Seaweed is naturally an antifungal, antiviral, and anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, and a natural prebiotics. So really good for your body, basically. This is a nutritional bomb. But it's not only this. I mean, it's also good to feed animal with a lot of side benefit. It's also good as a biostimulant to support agriculture. It's also good as a substitute to plastic. We see that the best option to replace plastic may come from seaweed. Actually, there are a lot of amazing startups that are doing a great job at the moment to replace plastic with compostable or even edible packaging. So that's which would be great to replace cotton as well. Cotton is 2% of the cultured in the world and 25% of pesticides and 10% of herbicides. So replacing cotton is not a bad idea. And when we talk about synthetic fibers, this is the biggest contributor to microplastic pollution. Seaweed can support life in the ocean. It provides marine habitat and support wildlife in the ocean. That the best way to restore abundance in the ocean is to grow seaweed. Seaweed absorb a lot of greenhouse gas as well. I mean, think of the fact that seaweed can grow up to 40 centimeters a day, for some of them up to 60 meters high. So this is real forest. and they can sequester a lot of carbon. And then we should be reminded as well that these forests, these seaweed forests, are disappearing, are absorbing as much carbon as the entire Amazon forest, but are disappearing at an even faster pace because of global challenge we have. And so there's like a big fire underwater, but no one cares because no one sees that. So that's something to be reminded. So we have to preserve and protect and develop seaweed. And last but not least, seaweed also provide resources and jobs and revenue to coastal community where fishing resources are inexorably doomed to get very reduced and to decrease and to disappear gradually. And most of these jobs and revenues, notably in emerging countries, are going to women. 80% in Africa, for instance, in East Africa, all the revenues from seaweed are going to women. As such, it furthers women empowerment and gender parity in emerging countries, very traditional. So really, it ticks all the boxes. And the big thing, and my book is called The Seaweed Revolution, because it looks like we are still in the Stone Age when it comes to seaweed. I mean, you mentioned US. US has not yet moved to cultivation. So US is the largest maritime territory in the world. I mean, clearly. And it produces less than 0.1% of the global seaweed production in the world. So outcome, we are in the Stone Age. So 12,000 years ago, we moved from prehistory to modern history, and we managed to feed a lot of people, moving from hunters, gatherers to becoming farmers. But yet we have not done this with the ocean. We are still totally uncivilized with the ocean. So it's time to enter a civilization of the ocean, which is once again 2/3 of our planet and 90% of life on Earth. So that's the idea, move to a new civilization, including the ocean. And I think the first action we should all have, especially you English-speaking people, we should change the name of seaweed, because over the various and many applications that I have seen, I mean, despite I've tried very hard, and I know people have tried all across the world, but you cannot smoke seaweed. So seaweed is not weed. So stop calling them seaweed, please. Let's call them sea vegetables, as they do in Asia. Just people so can understand it's delicious. Just call them sea forests, as they do in Norway, for instance. So people can understand we should protect them, just like we do with forests. But seaweed is absolutely irrelevant as a name.
Yeah, it's a misnomer. Thank you for clarifying that. So you guys are going to have to change your name from safe seaweed then to something
else. Exactly.
Safe greenies or something. Greenies.
Safe sea greens.
So you've actually brought up some amazing number of points, some of which I was going to ask you about, particularly the climate. Somebody quoted, I read an article in Time, and he said, the only way to feed the world population by 2050 that doesn't harm the environment is to scale up seaweed fishing. Now, what protections do you think you can afford seaweed's future sustainability so it doesn't become overproduced and then disrupt the ecosystem in the ocean?
So first of all, it needs to be science-driven. We need to work, which is why we created a coalition, a global coalition of seaweed stakeholders, already gathering 800 members. Because first of all, we need to work collectively and share experience, all of us. That's the one thing. Remember, seaweed is not something new. I mean, the seaweed revolution has started 60 years ago in Japan, China, and Asia. Today, 36 million tons of seaweed are produced in Asia out of cultivation. 99% of the global production, 97% of the global production in the world come from Asia. So you will first try to understand why Asia is the only one to use a resource that does not need land, nor fertilizers, and does not need to be watered. I mean, of course, seaweed doesn't need fresh water. And the reason is clear, because they need it first. I mean, they need to feed a fast-growing population back in the 50s. Mao Zedong, or the Japanese after the World War II, they were in huge need of seaweed. And in Ireland, Stefan can testify that when the famine came, the people were eating a lot of seaweed. So we learn about seaweed when we need them. So the question of offshore farming looks a bit irrelevant, because out of 66 million square kilometers that are suitable to seaweed farming, we only farm 2,000 square kilometers in the world today. So there's a long way to go. Seaweed, once again, is $15 billion of revenues in the world. Today, it's 8 million jobs. and growing at 10% a year in terms of revenues. So that's already massive. It's already there. The Asia is mastering seaweed. Of course, as mentioned by Shan, we should not reproduce the mistakes we did on land. We should avoid monoculture, GMO, and intensive farming. We should create a regenerative model, building seaweed in collaboration with fish and shellfish and so forth. So we could recreate ecosystem in the ocean. That's where the strong power. I mean, Wageningen calculated some years ago that with 2% of the world dedicated to a global permaculture and seaweed production, we could feed 12 billion people in protein with no need of animal or vegetable protein, which is quite interesting. So we are quite far from over farming. That said, we should be careful. And for that, I keep saying my commitment to seaweed as part of the UN and so forth is really an intergenerational commitment for the next generation. But I think we are responsible of what has happened, of what is happening right now. So we should offer them a solution. And I trust them to get a better sense of what is needed for the environment that we had. The level of awareness by young generation is very high in terms of being environmentally friendly. So we should trust them. We should leave them a chance. And I think once again, being led by science and making sure that what we do in the ocean will not disrupt it is critical. But also bear in mind, we are already destroying the ocean. I mean, don't think like the ocean is something preserved and untouched. I mean, the ocean is full of plastics. We have destroyed 50% of lives there. It's full of pollutants, of agricultural runoffs and so forth. So, I mean, we have destroyed the ocean. So it's time to repair them. And that's why we are using seaweed basically to repair the ocean.
Okay, somebody else has asked here, is there an opportunity for citizen boaters to be involved in setting their own kelp lines for carbon and nitrogen capture?
I think it's very hard to get the right, to get the license to cultivate seaweed is highly complex. I think in the US, it's easier to pump oil from the ocean than to grow seaweed because there's a lack of environmental guidelines and in the Western world, and because it's new and it scares everyone, and local authorities are worried of granting licenses. It's very complex, unfortunately, to grow seaweed in the ocean. And here again, we have to adapt to the change and each and every consumer. And if you want to be a citizen seaweed voter, then you have to eat seaweed. You have to consume each time you eat and you drink, three times a day, you are an environmental activist. You vote for the world you want. So if you start to investigate where to buy seaweed, where to buy product made out of seaweed or fed with seaweed or whatever, then you start to change the world. So I think let's start there. Because small farms in the ocean, there's a long way to go, unfortunately, but why not?
I think you three have all showed to us today that seaweed is generally a net positive. It helps us all to eat healthier, more sustainably, and lower down the food chain, which is all good stuff. So kudos, Stefan Cran, marine biologist and founder of the Seaweed Company in Galway. Sean Barrett, founder of Dr. Dish and the Montauk Seaweed Supply Company in Long Island, and Vincent Demoiselle, head of the Safe Seaweed Coalition, and added to a very rich global discussion about this. So thank you very much for your input. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, and you guys. So if you'd like to donate or just sign up for our newsletter, go to the website cambridgeforum.org. There you'll find a podcast of this program and many more. Keep doing the good work. Okay.
Go and buy seaweed.